But all that to say is that a kids program is one of the things that we know you can be assured, if you have a good kids program, or at least relatively assured, that your church is going to do well.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And certainly if you don't have one, you can be assured that your church will not be large.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast. We're seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith.
Mm-mm.
I'm Kent, and that over there...
Here I am.
Nathan,
I am
he's got to get his microphone in front of his mouth.
I'm just looking at my thing.
He's looking things up.
Okay, I'm here.
We're in a series called The Voice of the Shepherd. We're trying to understand how the gospel applies in normal life, daily life, the decisions we face. And today, we're going to talk about raising kids, how to raise kids informed by the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe as opposed to how to raise kids as informed by the culture, or maybe even how to raise kids as opposed to how to raise kids as informed by, like, traditional Christian values. Like, what have we kind of maybe, if we grew up in the church, learned that raising kids is supposed to, how it's supposed to work? Does the gospel say something different? Well, that's why we have Nathan here today.
yeah. I'd like to push back on that, but I guess it was my idea to talk about this. And I know it's really important to most people. I think since what? I don't know, maybe the 60s. It's really been a way that churches get people to attend. Good kids programs, parenting workshops and lessons and curricula.
People want their kids to have like a moral education or a religious education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess, you know, that's important, and we all want that, and maybe it's good, a good thing. It seems like it probably is, that people want that. You don't necessarily have to be a believer in Christ to want that for your kids.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are, maybe one of the great fears that we have is that our kids are going to, you know, wander off, or that they're going to get involved in something that's going to be hurtful to them. And mm-hmm. we want them to have their own moral center, some basis for making good decisions.
Yeah, and we want them to be part of a positive peer community.
Right.
Influencing them to make good decisions.
Yeah, we know that they're going to have peers, and that those peers are going to have an effect on them as they develop, just a part of human development. And, you know, as parents, we know that there's not a whole lot we can do when they're in that phase directly, but indirectly, we can maybe orchestrate a set of peers around mm-hmm. them so that we can at least give them the best chance that we can
mm-hmm.
of growing up well. So
that sure is a cynical view, Nathan, of
it's not,
church.
It's good. It's a good
thing.
You know,
children's ministry, youth ministry.
Yes.
Yeah. Seems kind of cynical. Like, you know, the parent. Is it cynical of the church or cynical of the parents?
I don't think it's
both.
It's a system, maybe. It's just a system. And it makes sense. There's a codependency, and we need to say this, and everybody probably knows it, but there's a, churches, really, you're either going to build a church on faith, and I don't even know how to do that, to be honest.
You're trying.
You know, I guess, yeah, and it's not easy, and I really most days don't have a ton of hope that it's going to do anything more than just what it is, and that's fine. I mean, what it is fine, but if I were setting out and I was saying, you know, I want to have an impact. And I want to influence my society for Jesus, really, because I love God, because at least partially, you know. And I knew a lead pastor one time who was like, you know, don't bother with pure motives. Nobody knows. You know, everybody has impure motives. Don't bother trying to figure that out, you know. Do good stuff. Mm-hmm. And if there's, you know, if there's some selfishness mixed in there or something, you know, untoward mixed in there, then it'll work itself out. You know, if you wait until your motives are 100% pure, you'll never do anything. And maybe he's right, you know. But I guess I'm of the other mindset. I'm kind of like, look, your motive's everything. Just my, but, you know, someone would say, well, I like the way we do things better than the way you don't. You know, that that we're accomplishing all of this, and all these people are hearing about Jesus, and there are all these people who are involved, and there's these relationships being formed and these initiatives being carried out. And all of that is because we decided not to stand on principle entirely, but to say, you know, sometimes people do things because they have some form of ambition, and that's okay, you know, or whatever. And it's those people who really get things done. And but all that to say is that if I were setting out to build a big church for God, but also maybe for whatever other reasons that I have, okay, that I was, what I want is, I have a goal, is to have a church with significant numbers so that we can do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's my goal. Now, if you have that goal, you set out to do that, there's no guarantee that that's ever going to happen. You know, the idea that you could somehow coalesce a bunch of people together around this esoteric idea, you know, about Jesus, it's probably not likely, and it's certainly not guaranteed. So, you know, Paul goes out, or anybody, you read in the New Testament and the book of Acts, and all these things are happening, and these churches are springing up. But what we don't think about is oftentimes these churches were already there, in the sense that there were a lot of Gentile seekers of Yahweh, that God had been working for centuries to bring that moment about. And so by the time the message about Jesus is being preached, you had a Jewish population, a diaspora Jewish population especially, who were at least familiar with the ways of the pagan people and maybe had friends that were among the Gentiles. And it's harder for them to say, well, we're right and you're wrong. I mean, I'm sure they did, but they're, you know, they see virtue over there. They see people over there who really want to do good. And then you have Gentiles. And I really think that the prophets spoke about this. I'm trying to, the reference escapes me now, but I think it's in Ezekiel, where he talks about how God's going to, you know, he's going to scatter his people out there. But then in doing so, he's going to have the Gentiles right where he wants them. You know, everybody's going to be able to hear about him. Mm-hmm. So this moment of God's discipline and wrath on Israel, and that he scattered them into the nations, meant also that the nations would now have this influence, this Yahwist influence out in their midst. So that was, what, 586 BC, you know, when that began to happen. So you have these little colonies of believers in Yahweh, and these regular meetings at synagogue and stuff, and kind of a rhythm that forms in a decentralized way out in the world. So when they go and preach, you've got a bunch of Gentiles who are interested in Yahweh, who just didn't want to go through an elective surgery, you know, or whatever.
This was their church growth strategy, you might say.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so God had orchestrated this moment for hundreds of years so that when they come and they begin to preach about a Messiah has come, and that the nations are welcomed in, that was, it resonated. Mm-hmm. It was a very dry tinderbox waiting for a spark. Mm-hmm. And so the gospel came. And all that to say is that a big movement really is going to happen one of two ways, either a divine hand, you know, or through maybe the principles of the world, as we've spoken about, that we can leverage things, that there are things that we can use in social and psychological dynamics to bring about a movement or an organization or whatever.
Right. Someone, a leader with charisma, people aspiring to be good people or have their kids raised well or to be part of something. And so all those dynamics come together and boom, it's happening.
Right. Yeah. So you go to a conference. Right. And there's always principles to be used. Now, if the principles are something other than preach the gospel and pray, then it's beginning to reach into, and you know, if we get any pushback, maybe it'll be on this, but you know, it's beginning to reach into manipulation in some way. If I need people, if I have to have a certain number of people involved in what I'm doing in order for what I'm doing to happen, that there's a codependency right there. I need them to need me, You know, and so I have to create this kind of, I guess we use branding now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, branding is a big thing, and it's a big thing in church growth conferences and things. People talk about their personal brand, and then we talk about our corporate brand or identity. You know, mm-hmm. And hey, I was a big proponent of that, advocate for it. But as I've gotten farther away from it, I've just realized what was I doing? I mean, it's a great way to build an organization. So, several books that have come down the pipe that are things like Good to Great, mm-hmm. which I've not read, but I've heard about. You know, and then 7 Habits, Highly Effective People. Mm-hmm. These books are written one by an unbeliever, one by a Mormon.
I think Jim Collins is a believer. He actually, Good to Great, Jim Collins.
I'll have to go back and look. I think he may not have been when he wrote the book, but we'll look.
I don't know. I don't know that. I just know he ended up being a speaker at Christian conferences and stuff. Right. And I know that may be because the churches just thought he had great principles, so they asked him in. But I thought that he was saying, "Yeah, I'm one of you guys."
Yeah,
I could be wrong.
Well, we'll look it up. You guys look it up out there. But yeah, to my understanding, he wasn't at least not when he was, mm-hmm. and he was invited to church conferences.
Yeah.
And
which is your point? I think
which is my point. Yeah, yeah. So this isn't you know, there are principles that we can tap into that will move people. So, you know, Saul Alinsky's book Rules for Radicals is about organizing. Right. Ultimately, it's about organizing people around a cause, leveraging the power of a multitude to accomplish some sort of a change in the world. We get enough people together, we can affect things. Mm-hmm. But I would suggest, a lot of these principles are just very eerily similar to the people at Babel in Genesis 11. You know, let's build. Mm-hmm. Make a name for ourselves, mm-hmm. lest we be scattered. Mm-hmm. Man, that's scary. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a scary idea because it doesn't take faith to do that. You don't need faith to accomplish these ends. You just need a set of skills.
Yeah, in the world, there's you can generally expect results to come from hard work, from working smarter, working harder. You know, employing ingenuity, mm-hmm. and all, you know, and all the techniques of the modern age.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mentioned 7 Habits and the Mormon Church, but, you know, the Mormon Church, I think, is a case study in these methods of manipulation of large groups of people that being orchestrated as a religious organization, really unapologetically so. Mm-hmm. So, I think most churches, you know, very large churches realize that it's important to pray that, you know, unless the Lord builds a house, they labor in vain, that we have things that are kind of moderating this drive to control, you know, or to somehow sway others. Mm-hmm. Now we use it because it just has to be done, but we also have something kind of pushing back, and we know that. The Mormon Church doesn't have that. You know, the church is this embodiment of God on earth, and so what they decide and what they do is inherently correct. and when you have that dynamic, then you can do any of these things you want, and they've been successful at it. You know, Joseph Smith boasted that he had done more in his lifetime than Jesus, you know, which is true. I mean, he'd had a much larger following for much longer through very difficult circumstances, you know, and then Brigham Young building on that. I don't know if you've seen American Primeval, but it is the story of how when you use these principles that there's a personal cost to your soul. Which is why I think we see a lot of mega church pastors that, you know, have this fall because a lot's built on them. Now, I guess we set out to talk about childbearing. I don't know how I got here, but all I have to say is that a kids program is one of the things that we know you can be assured if you have a good kids program, or at least relatively assured, that your church is going to do well. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. And certainly if you don't have one, you can be assured that your church will not be large, we'll say. Mm-hmm. You know, doing well, I guess it just depends on your metric. Mm-hmm. But large, you know, if we say to parents, hey, you know, you're raising your children, you're discipling them, that's you, and we can say that with our words, and we do, but you know, if we don't also provide some sort of experience for the kids, and we can be sure that people are not going to stick around, right? And it speaks to market forces and competition, but everybody wants their kids to at least be decent people. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And I would say everybody. I mean, some people have kids and they're kind of like lizards, I guess, and they just kind of have them, and they, you know, the kids may be there and they may be fed, but they don't really think, who's this person becoming, or what do I owe them in terms of just development? But when we get to, and by the way, I'm a former kids and children and family pastor, so this is from somebody who's been a part of the whole machine, and you know, again, I was well intentioned. It was just it was difficult to really find compelling purpose in that for me, because it was redundant to some degree. When I'm thinking about actually discipleship, and a lot of resources went to something that was somewhat redundant, unless the purpose is to get people under the roof.
You mean it's redundant because it's like parents can do this at home. Why are we doing this here? And you know, we're spending a lot of effort to do it, to have the volunteers and to have the programs to teach these kids at church when parents can teach this stuff at home,
right? And do a better job.
And do a better job. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe being in the assembly is better for kids. Some people would contend that. Mm-hmm. You know, having an intergenerational gathering, something that doesn't just have a feature of 45-minute lecture, you know, that's boring the kids' brains out, you know. All of these things could be done differently, but we have the way we do it. And so, you know, kids' ministry, I think, at the end of the day, is just support and, you know, babysitting to some degree, to allow for this long lecture to be a part of the assembly, you know.
You mean to allow for the preaching, the sermon, the adult gathering?
Right, yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, you know, because, hey, I was also that kid who just, you know, did not want to be dragged to church. Mm-hmm. Because when I was a kid, everybody was in there. You know, you may have had Sunday school, but you also went to church. You know, it wasn't like an alternative. Yeah, that was brutal as a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, just sitting there for somebody droning on, mm-hmm. you know, for 45 minutes at a time. It's not something I look forward to, it's certainly on Sunday mornings. So, especially when there was television, you know. Other
things. When I could have been home watching TV.
Yeah, nowadays I can't imagine how hard it is, you know, how hard it would be. So, we want to raise our kids, right? We want our kids to be righteous people. But what does the gospel say about raising righteous children?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that. What does the gospel say about raising kids? And just what immediately came to mind is the simple admonition in Ephesians and maybe also in Colossians, parents, raise your children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, okay, all right, put myself back into that passage. What's going on there? I think Paul is taking the standard parts of life, and he's talking about, you know, masters and slaves, and then he's talking about husbands and wives, and then he's talking about children, and he's providing a brief snippet of insight into how the gospel transforms each of those spheres of society. So he's kind of taken sort of on the one hand, the thing everybody knows, discipline your children. Mm-hmm. Like everybody in the world knows, you got to raise your children in discipline. That's unquestioned. But he's going to say, now do it in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And he doesn't much spell that out. Maybe he has another line that follows. fathers, don't exasperate your children, I think is somewhat said in there.
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't think he totally spells that out. Mm-hmm. But I think he's trying to say what we're trying to get at, which is there's a gospel way of raising kids.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And there's... Maybe the whole, you know, ambling on here was a preamble to this statement is that, you know, there's just so little in the New Testament about raising kids. You know, I mean, the fact that Paul has something in his letter addressed to children, in Ephesians 6:1, oh, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right, suggests that there's at least, you know, the kids were there. You know, they weren't in some separate experience just because they're being addressed in the common assembly. And then honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise. Now, you know, what's interesting is he resorts to scripture, the Old Testament, when he's addressing the children. And so here's, you know, the promises, so that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy a long life on the earth. And then fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training instruction of the Lord. And fathers can mean parents there. So yeah, that's all we get. You know, we get very little about child rearing, which, you know, in those days, child rearing was something that was, it maybe it wasn't as fraught as it is now because there were these roles, you know, maybe since the 60s or whatever, there's this, been this notion of children having this kind of agency. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that previously that, you know, I don't know, you watch old movies and, you know, some kid's acting out in the street and some strange adult grabs them and boxes them around the ears, you know. And I'm not saying we should go back to those days. I'm just saying that, you know, it wasn't that long ago, half a century ago, maybe a little more, that children were supposed to conform to society. You know, that was their job. They were expected by everybody, not just their parents, but society as a whole. If a child was being loud or obnoxious or disruptive or whatever, you know, that was an infraction against maybe an unspoken social contract. So people felt the right to at least call that kid down, right? And that's an American thing. It's, you know, I think it's probably a Western European thing. Other cultures don't have that, haven't had that. They are more like, you know, they're a child, let them be a child and run roughshod, and the society has to just tolerate them until they get old enough to.
I would have thought you'd say, like, Eastern societies, honor shame cultures, it would be just a stronger conformity.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I would say Southeastern Asian cultures. Yes. I'm thinking like in India, in some of those cultures, Latin American cultures, kids are kind of the, you know, they're seen as this treasure. And so they're treasured and they're allowed to do kind of mostly what they want. So, yeah, I mean, around the world, we kind of all have our own view. And as the United States has become more diverse, then, you know, we have, I don't know, a different idea on childhood. I don't know if you've been around in, you know, especially in Springdale, where you have a high percentage of Latin American folks, you know, and if a kid's bored, then, you know, mom's going to put on a cartoon on her phone, but the audio is just turned up. Like, there's not headphones or anything. And that's so common. It's been so common in my experience that I have to think it's a cultural thing. But you know, for me, I would be mortified if I'm actually in a doctor's waiting room and I'm making enough noise that everybody in the waiting room can hear this program on television. But the mentality there is that, you know, it's not an imposition because it's a child, you know?
Right. They get to do what they want.
Right. Yeah. You know, and that's understood. You're going to tolerate that because there's a kid here, right? And that the rest, so there's the social contract there, at least for them culturally, is that they're kids. They're going to be kids, right? You know, you go to Walmart, used to be more so. I mean, especially all of us uptight white people, we who were the shop owners and stuff, we get really upset because the kids go to, you know, the store with mom and they kind of part ways and the kids find stuff to play with, you know, really without restraint.
Yeah.
But, you know, over here, Western culture, European cultures, we have this property rights thing. Like, don't touch that. It doesn't belong to you. I don't care how old you are. And so, you know, we have a very different approach to things. But all that to say is that I think cultures previously, you know, ancient cultures where survival, you know, was not a given. I think that kids really had to conform, you know. And so maybe that's why there's not as much material in the New Testament about raising kids. But for us, it's, you know, it's critically important, right? So,
well, it seems like in Paul's statement, he's assuming it's understood that children should obey their parents.
Right.
Conformity is the norm.
Mm-hmm.
But he adds, do it in the Lord.
Yeah.
And then of course, it's understood that parents are disciplining their children. But he mm-hmm. adds, do it in the Lord.
Yeah. Right. Just like a lot of the other things. You know, when he tells the slaves to obey their masters,
yeah.
As you would obey Christ.
Right.
So they're going to obey their masters. You know, they're going to try to not, I guess, at times. But, and that's the difference. If somebody has to be just coerced into a thing as opposed to whether somebody chooses to do a thing. And so I think it's interesting, though, that Paul appeals to certain motivations that he doesn't appeal to with the adults in the church. So and he says, obey your father and mother. And then he says, this is the first command. Okay. Now, remember, Paul has been telling people this whole time that in all of his letters that we're free, that we're not supposed to try to keep the Old Testament law. Mm-hmm. You know, he even tells somebody if you get circumcised, then you're obligated to keep the whole law. You've fallen from grace. I mean, he really kind of creates this crisis, this dichotomy. And yet he turns to the children and he says, obey your parents and the Lord, for this is right
mm-hmm.
versus wrong, mm-hmm. which this motivation isn't normally. Paul would not just say this thing is right. He would say this is loving, or this is faithful, or this is obedient. But even declaring this right and that wrong, he doesn't do a whole lot, you know, because for the most part, those questions are beneath us. You know, if I'm asking right and wrong, I really am trying to find the line where I can not have to, you know, how much do I have to do?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Whereas the person who is transformed by the gospel, that they're chasing God, that they're not even concerned with it. You know, Paul says that give yourself as a slave to righteousness. And when you do that, that, you know, sin is going to begin to die. You know, mm-hmm. it's going to release you. So there's a pursuit as opposed to, you know, this line not to be transgressed. So he says, do this in the Lord, for it's right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment. And then he says, with a promise that it may go well with you and that you may live and enjoy a long life on the earth.
What do you make of that?
I don't know. Yeah.
You're just saying, hey, I'm just really curious about that, because
yeah.
he doesn't very often appeal to the Old Testament law.
Right.
Occasionally he does.
Right.
But he's the guy who says we're free from the law.
Right.
But maybe it's because children are more under the elementary principles of the world. They're under the parents' authority, and their job is to conform to their parents until at such a time when they are independent and have agency. And so he's like,
so.
You know, that's just the position they're in. They're under so. Law.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And remember, the law is a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's, you know, maybe it's wise to teach the kids the, you know, the Decalogue, the Pentateuch, these kinds of things, to really, if you're wanting to raise your children to know God, maybe it's important to give them that background. I think you certainly give them a leg up toward a genuine faith that has substance. You remember, we said that, you know, God took 500 years, 600 years to bring the Gentile world kind of on board. But he did it through observant Jews.
Yeah. So are you saying it lays a good foundation because they learn like the fear of the Lord? I mean, I certainly wouldn't question someone saying having a biblical background is good preparation. But I would think you would question living under law.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you would think living under law is not a good background.
Right. I wouldn't say that. No, I wouldn't say that.
You wouldn't
at all.
Say that.
No.
Because it kind of prepares you for Christ.
Law is a great background. Yeah.
Because you realize that law doesn't make you righteous.
Yeah. I mean, Paul lived under law, right? And I think that prepared him. Now, so
it prepares you negatively.
Huh?
It prepares you negatively.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it could be, but also it's like, I think lesson one of that God needed us to know out of the gate was that He's holy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and So I think of the ministries of Elijah and Elisha as being tandem and really representative of two big lessons that we have to know about God. One is Yahweh is God. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean to be God, right? It means he gets to say, right? And we don't question him. We do what he says because he's God, right?
And that includes he issues commands.
Yeah.
And our job is to obey them.
Right. And it's his right to punish. Mm-hmm. And that there is such a thing as consequence and punishment. All of that, I think, is important. I think somebody who's raised entirely permissively until life punishes them hard enough is probably going to have a hard time with the gospel, because the notion of divine wrath and this kind of salvific death on my behalf and all that. I mean, I'm going to be like, who is this God? Why does he think he can tell me what to do? You know, why would Jesus have to die for me when, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a decent person and all that. And I think that somebody really, and I get, it gets back to maybe some of this Puritan upbringing, which I'm going to correct in a minute, but you know, used to be the Puritans, they thought their job was to get their kids to believe that they were just the worst possible sinners to prepare them for the gospel. So they would take this approach of just really bringing kind of the hammer down and teaching of a wrathful God, and in the hopes that their children would have this conversion moment and have this appreciation for redemption. And I don't think that's entirely wrong. It seems that God spent a lot of time in the Old Testament teaching people don't mess with him. You know, you've got stories like Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus 10 who offered strange fire to the Lord, and fire, you know, burst out and consumed them, right? That in Exodus 33 and 34, you know, when, or maybe a little earlier, when the golden calf issue comes up, you know, and God's just going to wipe out all of Israel. You know, I mean, he kills the firstborn in Egypt. And I know that all of that's kind of bloody maybe for preschoolers, but at some point we have to tell them these stories, even though they may be hard, because they show that God, you know, God's not to be trifled with, and he has the right to judge. He's not like you and I. And I think, you know, we've talked about this before, that one of my great peeves is when someone tries to redact the Old Testament, because, you know, God took a few centuries to teach people this lesson that he's holy. Mm-hmm.
So raising our kids under discipline and instruction, under law, so to speak, where there's consequences, and that's parental rules and family rules, but it's also God's rules, God's laws, and mm-hmm. Is good for them.
Yeah.
And prepares them for a responsible adult life, and it prepares them for being a Christian, for returning to Christ and recognizing their need.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because the other lesson, which you didn't get to, is Elisha, the lesson God saves, Yahweh right. saves.
Right? Right, right. That's the tandem. And these two lessons have to go together. But God put them in two different people initially because they commingle. If we don't have a good vessel where these contradictory statements almost, you know, can come together. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's some wisdom, especially as a child is very young. I mean, I've known parents that, you know, little Timmy does something bad, you know, he hits his brother or something like that. And the mom will get down, you know, she'll squat down in front of little Timmy and she'll explain how his brother is hurt by that and how, you know, and you can just watch little Timmy. He does not care. Mm-hmm. You know, he is not swayed by this. He does not pity his little brother, you know. Mm-hmm. And no matter how much you try to explain to him that he should love his little brother and he shouldn't have hurt him, he doesn't get it, mm-hmm. you know. And next time you turn your back, guess what he's going to do? So they're developmentally, sometimes people just don't have the resources. You know, again, the law was a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. The law is for the immature and the developing. And so if you, and I think that approach of just actions have consequences and things like that is critically important, especially when raising small children. And so I think that that's what Paul's driving at, in that he's kind of borrowing from the Old Testament. I mean, and there are other places where he could have borrowed from the Old Testament, like when we talked about making a collection for the saints in Jerusalem. It would have been so easy, man, to go back there and to grab some of those passages that are on the top about tithing and stuff, right? Would have been so much easier than to try to nuance and finesse people, mm-hmm. you know, to tell them, hey, don't give if you don't want to give. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's essentially what he's saying. He's saying God loves a cheerful giver, you know, mm-hmm. give as you purposed in your heart. Don't give what somebody else is giving. I'm not setting a percentage. I'm not setting a threshold. Search your heart.
Yeah.
That's how you should give. That's a very different approach from what was found in the Old Testament law, mm-hmm. right?
Adults get different instruction than kids.
They do. They do.
People under the gospel get different instruction than people under the law.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think Paul would have promised anybody a long life. You know, just to be really frank, that if you're following Christ, you're probably not promised a long life. Mm-hmm. At least, especially in those days or in any place where you're in a closed country. And yet he says, you know, do this so that it may go well with you. You may enjoy a long life on the earth or in the land. And so, you know, to whom would that appeal? That instruction, right? I mean, certainly everybody would, we all prefer to live to being killed, right? Mm-hmm. But I think part and parcel, when Paul says in Philippians 3, I've not yet been perfected, it seems that, especially when we read the Ante-Nicene fathers, you know, the patristic fathers, that being perfected was synonymous with martyrdom, mm-hmm. That you really hadn't experienced all of Christ's sufferings until you had died for your profession. Mm-hmm. So the adults, I think, wouldn't have resonated as much with converted adults, people who are true believers in the room. But we don't expect that from children, you know? And I'm like, Timmy, if you do really well, someday you might, you know, you might be executed on, you know, on a Roman pyre. That'll be great. You know, it's not going to be something. And I'm not saying that what Paul said was untrue, but I'm saying that we don't want to die from folly. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I've kind of had this aspiration in life. I don't have very many aspirations in life, but one is not to die from stupidity. Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, I don't care really what my epitaph says, even if whatever it says, as long as it isn't, man, you know, he put himself here, whatever, you know. And I think that's kind of what's being promised, is that, you know, Paul's saying, you're not going to make good decisions. You're not going to make healthy decisions if you don't listen to your parents. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the promise of the Old Testament command. And so Paul tells them that. So when he says raise them in the training and instruction of the Lord, you know, what does that mean for us? You know, I think that the only training and instruction of the Lord that would have been available to those people would be what they heard at synagogue, you know, what the Lord had trained Israel in. And so I do think we really set our kids up for success if we give them a very rich telling of these stories that they remember, and try to let the morality be maybe more of a consequence. You know, I think we do a lot to try to teach our kids morality, but I think we just teach them sometimes inauthenticity. Let me give an example. Like a kid does something to his friend, right? He, you know, takes his thing, or he breaks his thing, or whatever it is that he does to his friend. And we don't like that. He did that to his friend, and we're embarrassed that he did that to his friend. And, you know, because his friend's parents are standing there, and his friend's parents are thinking, what a terrible kid, and these parents must be terrible, you know. And we begin to kind of have this sense of scorn. And so we grab him and we take him over there. And what do we tell him?
Well, like your illustration from before, you know, Timmy, you should tell your friend you're sorry. You
right,
know?
Right.
Say
you're
so
sorry. What have we taught Timmy?
To be inauthentic,
right? To lie, right? Yeah, to lie in social situations. You know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't, as adults, confess the wrongs that we've done, but I think that assumes a degree of remorse and things like that. You know, so I think it's appropriate for the parents to apologize and say, "Hey, you know, I'll buy him another one." And I'm sorry about that. And then when you get home, you know, whatever consequence that you have for Timmy, you know, because Timmy only, he's only really sorry about things that cause him pain at that moment. And to expect more is so naive and foolish for us to do. And we really don't do Timmy any favors. We don't do ourselves any favors, you know. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about, and that I think we have to have an informed just legalism, I guess, when it comes to kids. And it just goes to show, you know, Paul says time and time and time again, the law is not bad. The law is good. Use it well.
Right.
You know, it's bad if you don't use it right.
Right.
But, you know, he says the law is not for righteous people. But I'm going to tell you, your kids are not righteous people. You know, and so they need it. And whatever that looks like for you, if somebody doesn't have access to scriptures, you know, then whatever the do's and don'ts of your society, and being consistent and being realistic.
Now, and so some people are reacting to what you're saying now, or to what they think you're saying, by because it sounds to them like you're advocating being harsh and domineering and mean to kids. And I don't think you are saying that. And when Paul says raise your kids in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, there's surely some element there of kindness mixed with law. Well, so it's like this very matter of fact imposition of the consequences, and not harsh and mean and judgmental.
Of course. And I think that that's what the gospel teaches us, is the gospel informs the law. Remember, we don't just have the law. We actually can wield the law because we have the gospel. Okay. And what the gospel announces is, and it is that container that holds the Elijah-Elisha ministry together, right? And we don't want to lose the Elijah side for the sake of Elisha, or Jesus will have died for nothing. You know what I'm saying? Like, we've missed it. If we lose the idea that God is a God of judgment and wrath, as well as a God of love and mercy, and that those are together in the cross, which to me, the cross and the great value of the cross in terms of how we treat other people, our subordinates, in this case, our children, is that we separate the person from their actions. You know, the cross is this super sharp scalpel that will separate the value of the individual from what they do. It gives us the ability, because here's the problem that we have. Is we're afraid that if we come down on someone's behavior, we've indicted their person, right? Or that if we endorse their person, we're endorsing their behavior. And and that's a struggle. You look at approaches to parenthood, right? And I think about the Montessori method, okay? And I don't have a degree in pedagogy or any of that. I don't know. I'm sure the Montessori method works well. It's been around for a long time and all that. But one feature of it is that there's no discipline, right? That there's this idea that the kid has kind of within them. And I think that Marie Montessori was a Christian and trying to leave these principles out. But there's this thing that they're created kind of with a destiny and a purpose, and we're just trying to find that in there, right? And so if you do a lot of top-down authoritarian discipline, you may confine them, and I think there's some truth in that. But the Montessori schools tend to not have any sort of consequences for bad behavior. They try to find ways around that. They assume
redirect
that, children are basically good, and that, you know, if whatever violence they have is taught to them by some sort of heavy-handed parenting or whatever, right? And if that's your philosophy, the problem is what I discovered from friends that had boys in the Montessori school was that the only alternative they have is to basically kick the kid out. And so what you get is, if you're overly permissive, what you have that person's behavior is so enmeshed with who and what they are, that they become the liability instead of their actions. And then they have to just be banished. Mm-hmm. Man, that's a scary thing, you know, and it's why progressivism, I think, can be dangerous. Why very progressive movements throughout history, because, you know, they, on one side, it's about compassion. It's about affirming the basic good of humankind and our potential to achieve utopia if we're given the opportunity, right? That's the dream of kind of a progressive mindset. The problem is that there will always be those people who don't buy it. And what do you do with them if you don't have a worldview that separates someone's behavior from their essence and who they are? Okay. If you can't address someone's behavior separate from who and what they are, then the only answer is you have two answers. One, tolerate as long as you can, and then execute. You know, I mean, there's a reason that communist revolutions would just, you know, that there was major swaths of the population that would just be, you know, sent away to die. And that, and I'm not, I don't want to be overly dramatic, but I'm saying that the Montessori method is kind of that in micro, in the sense that without the ability to address someone's behavior and to distinguish that from who and what they are, all you know, if they don't play along, your only option is just to be rid of them. And that's, to me, that's far worse than to just address their behavior and to give them these little consequences along the way.
Right. Yeah. And there's sort of a crisis in parenting nowadays where we feel that if we condemn an action, we've condemned the person.
Right.
And so we don't condemn the actions for fear that we will condemn the person, because we confuse the distinction you're making.
Right. Right. And I mean, to me, that the very fundamental truth of the gospel is you are not what you do. You are what you were made, you know, that you were made by God. You are what you're from. You know, so Jesus comes and he says, you don't know me because you don't know where I'm from and where I'm going. And that is the essence of who I am. Now, what I've done certainly can have an effect on those things, you know, it can have an effect not on where I'm from, but it can, but we'll get into that some other day. But anyway, but I think that the gospel gives parents the resources to affirm the child's dignity, their value as a creation of God, as having a destiny, of someone for whom Christ died, whatever they do. And I think that throughout their life that we have to remain and retain that posture, because as our kids get older, maybe they, you know, at some point they're making their own choices. And those choices, most of the times, at least some of them, are going to disappoint us, you know. But it doesn't mean that it's some sort of a deal breaker, that they're, you know, I don't think we have to grieve over our children's decisions or behaviors like people in the world, because those are not the final word. And so they're not the defining moment. None of these moments are the defining moments. You know, Christ can redeem anything, no matter where somebody is or how far they've fallen. And so we have a persistent optimism toward our kids as we're raising them, and even once they're raised, that keeps us from falling into some sort of a panic.
Right. Which enables us to love them better.
Right. And make better choices and respond to them better, to keep a cool head, to retain that trust. Because most of the well-intentioned harm I've witnessed being done to children is because the parents have some degree of fear. You know, fear for what Johnny's going to become, fear for what other people think of them because of Johnny's behavior, you know. And when a person has this deep and abiding faith in God, then they can react to these things in a way that's above the circumstance. You know, they're not just trying to quell something, you know, but they're able to see the bigger picture and to develop the kid and, you know, to endure maybe momentary embarrassment over their children's behavior or whatever, without coming down on them because they've embarrassed dad in public. and to have a realistic notion toward their behavior and what they're going to do, not have some set of expectations that they should act better than this, or they should be like this kid down the road or whatever, mm-hmm. you know. I really do think that the gospel prepares the heart of the parent to deal in a way that's healthy with the kid. And so we would affirm that, that this child is a creation of God, that they're made in the image of God, that Jesus died for their sake, right? That their value is tied to things that are non-negotiable, mm-hmm. regardless of what they do, mm-hmm. you know, and that they should live with an awareness and an understanding of that, even from their earliest memories. Mm-hmm. At the same time, their actions are not all equally good, mm-hmm. you know, and that actions have consequences. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. You know, God did not ultimately reveal himself in words. He's ultimately revealed himself through action. You know, that the cross is an action in history. These are events. Like, God gave a lot of words to Israel, you know. And those words don't seem to have done a whole lot, mm-hmm. you know, for them. But it is through these actions. And I think that one of the great mistakes that most parents make is using way too many words. You know, we think our words have a punitive value. Mm-hmm. And all they do is they assault our children's souls. You know, if let's say I don't want to perish the thought, maybe spank my child or ground them or whatever, you know, whatever consequence. I don't want to do that. It's trouble for me, you know. They certainly don't want that. And so what I'm left with is trying to find a way to make my words punitive enough mm-hmm. to try to fulfill that purpose that an actual consequence would. So maybe I use more of them. Maybe I use them louder, or maybe I choose ones that are particularly hurtful. Mm-hmm. And now kids don't want to be scolded. They don't, you know, but they choose a scolding over a spanking or over a timeout or grounding, you know, or whatever it is that you wanted to use. So, and every kid's different, but I'm just saying there has to be a consequence. Words are like money, you know. The more of them there are, the less they're worth. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that as you know, we raise small children, that you know, we have to learn from God. And God teaches us that actions have consequences, especially under these elementary principles of the world, as our children are. But those consequences don't mean we're not loved. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think
the consequences could help a person. I mean, what we'd like to happen for kids and adults is for consequences to help a person look inside and see there's something wrong inside mm-hmm. that produced the bad action, because the actions come from the heart. But that doesn't mean you're not loved, but though it may mean you have a darkness in you, mm-hmm. evil within you,
yeah.
and that needs to be dealt with. But yeah. God has provided a solution for that.
Right, right. And we certainly, you know, we don't want to teach our kids that they're somehow, you know, flawed or whatever. They'll discover that on their own. We just need to address their actions and separate that from who and what they are. I guess that's we spend a lot of time not talking about parenting, and I do think that there's maybe more to be said about it, but maybe for another time.
All right, yeah. Good talk. Thanks, everybody. If you got questions, you can always email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks. We'll see you next time.